Grant Natural Resources will come to order. First bill on the agenda is Senator Scheid and Rummel, but I don't see them here, so we will begin with Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Hold myself together here quickly. I wasn't expecting to jump up so quickly. I'm here to present Senate File 549, which is a bill that we refer to as a Building Sensible Communities Bill. Mr. Chair and members, what this bill seeks to do is to create that connection between our climate change and our transportation policies, and it also talks about how our transportation policies are connected to our land use policies throughout the state. We're going to be able to get a handle on climate change in our state and in our world. We have to take a look at all of our activities. We've spent, as you know, Mr. Chair, members, a lot of time talking about how we generate electrical energy and the sources of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector. Last year, the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group met over a fairly actually short period of time, put together an outstanding report. Most of you have probably gotten a copy of that report or received a briefing on that report, and it showed that Minnesota's greenhouse gas emission profile, the activities, the things that we do through all parts of our economy contribute in roughly the same proportions as we see all over the rest of the country and the world. Certainly, the majority of those sources come from electrical energy generation, about 34%. That's a little bit more, a little bit less from our transportation sector, about 24%, 14% from agricultural activities, and the list goes on from there. That group met in response to the goals that we set forth in the Next Generation Energy Act and recognizing a fairly widely held scientific opinion that we need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 80% below 2005 levels by 2050. And that's the goal we've set for ourselves as a state. There's some benchmarks that we try to meet along the way, 15% below 2005 by 2015. It's pretty aggressive. 30% below 2005 by 2025. This bill looks to deal with those activities that come primarily, like I said before, from transportation activities. Transportation really isn't an activity or an endeavor unto itself. I give this speech quite a bit. It's a means to a larger end. It's about people who are going places to do things. When we think about what kind of transportation we need, we most often think of, you know, where do I need to get? I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to go here. I'm going to get in the bus and I'm going to go there. And how we plan for transportation facilities, how we plan for transit infrastructure, then follows exactly where people need to go. And the truth of the matter is those sorts of destinations come about through a much more complex interaction of policies, policies that take into account our zoning, our tax structure, our policies around fuel, our policies around automobile purchasing, home ownership policies, et cetera. So much of these kind of complicated policies have interacted, and it creates the built environment that we have today. Things are changing, though, and we can't simply proceed along the same path that we have. Demographics are changing. Fiscal realities are changing. Our environmental imperatives are starting to press on us. So what we've done in the past is not going to work as well in the future and worse. It might get us very diminishing outcomes. So our policies need to be changed. They need to be more flexible. They need to allow more choices and better public outcomes. Transit and electric cars in and of themselves aren't going to do the trick. We can build all the transit in the world, but if we continue to build a sprawled infrastructure that is in the greenfields and leapfrog development and beyond with five-acre lots, that's going to force a lot of folks into cars. It's going to reduce the amount of choices that they have. Their houses are going to be far away from their jobs, going to be far away from their shopping, going to be far away from their school. That's going to demand a lot of infrastructure That, in and of itself, will be very expensive and has a huge environmental impact by itself. Land use is a key lever. Making use of that existing infrastructure, allowing for a greater variety of uses that are in more proximity to one another, allowing for transit, biking, and walking alternatives to function better and more cost-effectively. There's a piece in the bill that talks about where we place schools, and schools built at the edge or the far out in farmers' fields outside of town force a lot of transportation activity and force a lot of development and redevelopment. That's very environmentally impactful. Mr. Chair, I have John Bailey, who can give a quick overview of why this bill is a great idea, and then I can walk through the bill after Mr. Bailey testifies, or I can walk through the bill now, whatever your pleasure is.
Yeah, let's walk through the bill. You'd like to go through it is fine.
All right. Well, of course, we have findings. You know, we love findings in the legislature. That's Section 1. It talks about how greenhouse gas reduction goals and land use planning and vehicle miles traveled are connected to each other as a policy goal. Section 2 talks about wetlands and simply recognizes the value of wetlands for their carbon sequestration properties in addition to all the other benefits that we heard so much about from Mr. Jasky and others, why our wetlands are important to us. But adds to that list. Section 3 allows for grants for local municipalities who are contemplating doing some land use changes to their zoning code that recognizes land use as an important function. They're going to be creating better land use patterns to support transportation, have environmental outcomes, et cetera. Section 4 asks that we start looking at and considering the implications for greenhouse gas emissions during our standard environmental reviews on projects and proposals. And in fact, Mr. Chair, it's been mentioned that we already provide for this in law, and the fact is that we have a lawsuit in which the finding of a judge very explicitly said this is not a required activity under our environmental assessments and our environmental review process. Section 4, that's about schools. Incredibly, schools, when a school district is contemplating a major renovation or building a new school, the school development guidelines actually have penalties if you don't have a certain amount of acreage, et cetera. And that's actually unique to Minnesota and kind of outside what a lot of other states do when in terms of setting forth the criteria and policies when school districts are considering either rehabbing or building a new school. It also lowers the threshold that triggers the requirement of building a new school. That's about making use of our existing infrastructure, saving money, and taking advantage of schools that are in place. And it also asks that criteria be added to look at the connection between transportation and other facilities that are nearby when schools are being sited. I think that's a very positive change, Mr. Chair. Section 7 establishes a vehicle miles traveled reduction goal for MnDOT. That's so that MnDOT can allow consideration of how to better and more efficiently use our overall transportation system rather than just serving the goal of accommodating more cars that want to travel faster. This places a goal, vehicle miles traveled reduction goal, alongside the other goals that we know MnDOT has around safety, around efficient use of resources, around congestion, around maintenance and maintaining our infrastructure. The next section, Section 7, has to do with metropolitan area development, and it includes greenhouse gas reduction as an item to be considered alongside all the other items that we consider when we're looking at metropolitan area development standards. Section 10 is similar to the MnDOT goal, is to recognize that the Metropolitan Council's unique role in guiding land use and corresponding regional investments in transportation and sewer services is recognized and should take into consider a vehicle miles traveled policy as well. Let's see. Section 11 has to do with the livable communities criteria and guidelines. The Livable Communities Fund is supported by a region-wide property tax levy. It was developed to give local communities a match for certain kinds of development that are desirable in our metropolitan area. And as those grants, those are competitive grants that we make to locals, and it adds vehicle miles traveled and greenhouse gas reductions as a criteria for those grants. Let's see. Section 12 has to do with vehicle miles traveled, including that in our local comprehensive planning. Those are the local plans that municipalities do in the metropolitan area, and it has to it asks that those plans are right now, and that dictates very specifically the zoning map that local units of government adopt. It guides their infrastructure, and those local plans are aggregated, and they inform the larger region's development guidelines. And those are right now being finalized and turned into the Metropolitan Council. It's a regular cycle, about 4-year cycle of updates to that. And it asks that we include the goals and the policy that's outlined in this bill in those comprehensive plan updates. But rather than waiting 4 years, which just delays the implementation and you know, in the future that we need to achieve sooner than later, it asks that we include those goals, do those updates within 2 years, and submit them to the Met Council. The Met Council can then act on their comprehensive set of policies. Section 13 is asking that the University of Minnesota be given an appropriation. I have an amendment, Mr. Chair. That appropriation would come from within the Livable Communities Fund, not the general fund, if my amendment is to go on. And that's to develop some of the technical resource and capacity that's reflected back in that earlier section around the comprehensive plan updates, to work with local municipalities as they're trying to adopt vehicle miles travel strategies in their local comprehensive plans. The next subdivision is an appropriation for the competitive grants that I spoke of earlier for municipalities who are going to be changing their zoning ordinances. Again, that'll come from the Community Development Fund. With that, I do have an amendment. I'm not sure what the amendment number is.
Pass that out.
It's the A1 amendment. No, I'll read the amendment. The first part of the amendment reads, the implemented policy shall not mandate that individuals who use their vehicles in their business model reduce their vehicle miles traveled. And that was a concern brought to me by the realtors. And I assured them that any policies that are developed by the Department of Transportation, you know, wouldn't reach into people's, you know, private choices, and wouldn't. And if they wanted to bring some comfort language forward, I would be very happy to include that. So they knew specifically that, you know, we weren't reaching into people's individual choices and their private behavior or how they were going to carry out their businesses. That would be clearly an overreach. And so they brought this language to me, and I'm happy to include that. And then the rest of the amendment just has to do with where we find the resources to do the grants to the metropolitan municipalities, as well as actually to municipalities outside the metropolitan area. So might have to have a little discussion about the appropriate use of the Livable Communities Fund, as well as the resources over to the University of Minnesota for that technical assistance that they're going to be asked to provide. With that, I'll move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Discussion, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, on 1, line 3 of the A1 amendment, what do you mean by using their vehicle in their business model? Isn't it just using it in their business?
Yeah, exactly. This language was brought to me by the realtors. But, I mean, if we want to use a different word, that's fine. But their concern was realtors, you know, drive around all day. That's what they do. And so they were worried that somehow there would be a policy that would restrict them from being able to drive their clients around from house to house to house.
So they
referred to it as their business model, but we called it their business strike model.
So, Mr. Chair, Wilson. Senator Dibble, that the fact that they use their car in that way is a business model rather than using it in their business. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know what the usefulness of the word model was in this.
Yeah.
I think it might
point.
Move to strike it.
Well, I'd move to delete model to see if anybody else wants to do it or not.
But I will incorporate that amendment.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
On the A1, all those in favor say
Mr.
aye.
Mr. Chairman, before
Excuse
that,
Senator Parasol.
What is the point of just having that application of your amendment? Why is it apply there? Aren't you trying to stop everybody from using their cars excessively?
Mr. Chair and Senator Parasol, I think it is a worthwhile goal if people have choices about how they get around. Right now, I think the problem is a lot of people just don't have choices. And so if we were, as we look to the future, right now so much of our policy is really, really drive housing subdivision over here, shopping center over there, business park over here, school over there.
Dog parks.
So
did we forget dog park?
Dog parks. You name it. Everything is scattered very,
park
very remote. And this bill doesn't seek to dictate anyone's specific activity, their private behavior. It simply seeks to allow for a policy framework so that there be more variety of development, and the development be allowed to occur so that people have choices about how they get around. So I would never support any policies that say, Joe or Jane, business person, you can't drive your car to work. You've got to ride the train. We had a meeting this morning, as a matter of fact. We were being educated about various forms of transportation and transit finance in other parts of the world, and Singapore was presented. And in Singapore, I did not know this, you're prohibited from driving your car every other day. Well, I would never support something. That's ridiculous. I certainly don't think that's the culture or the expectation in our tradition. So to the extent that an amendment like this reflects that, that's the goal.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chairman, if your intent is to, you say you don't want to interfere with personal choices and this kind of thing, well then, how in the world will you achieve a 15% reduction? Isn't that done by personal choices? Some of us have already done that by trying to combine our trips and not just running every which way. But those are choices people make. So who's going to change
monitor.
That?
Who's going to monitor?
Well, I think
Sarah Olson, is this to the amendment? I mean,
I was looking at the section of the amendment.
We could adopt the A1 to fine-tune Senator Dibble's bill, then we can get into discussion about
it. Well, Mr. Chairman, it's the first part of it amends that very section, so.
Okay.
Of the amendment, so.
Well, if you can find a way that we're dictating and mandating private choices and private behavior, I'm all ears. But I don't think this bill does that or seeks to do that. If it does do that, then there's a flaw to address it.
Senator Sharon.
Not to the amendment, sorry.
Okay. Further discussion on the A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Dibble, if I visualize this similar to the recommendation that was made to reduce our waste stream to the landfills by 25%, which was one of the original initiatives to reduce landfills, it wasn't imposed on individuals, but as a result of that overall objective, various counties and cities went about doing collections at the at the curbside. Various kind of ideas and plans were formulated because of that, but it wasn't. It's a similar concept that you're talking about here. Is that correct?
Correct. It's creating choices. It's creating incentives. Creating possibilities. Mm-hmm. People want to live on large acre lots at the edge of the metropolitan area. Drive around to all of their, and they may well, and that's fine. Other people might want to do something very different from that, for whatever reason. They're getting older. They have fewer kids. Or they like the idea of you know their job being very close to their house, being very close to where they shop, being very close to where they go to church and where their kids go to school, and all of that's accessible to their entire family through walking or biking or using transit of some sort. And right now there are significant barriers in how our policies are constructed to that sort of development.
Sharon.
Thank you, Chair. As I was reading through this fairly quickly here, did I understand in reading this that there is a process by which environmental subcommittees of a city council or something would review development plans in order to do some appraisal of what that development does in relationship to greenhouse motor vehicle miles traveled?
Asking for the update in the comprehensive planning.
And there's money available for cities to...
Yes, we make that an allowable use within the Livable Communities Fund. That's administered by the Metropolitan Council.
Let's move to your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I have John Bailey from Thousand Friends of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
My name is John Bailey with Thousand Friends of Minnesota. Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to present before you this afternoon, and thank you, Senator Dibble, for introducing this bill. Thousand Friends of Minnesota is a statewide membership organization promoting development that enhances the best aspects of Minnesota, thriving cities and small towns, healthy rivers, lakes, and streams, and a growing economy. This legislation that Senator Dibble introduced and I'll talk to you about is also one of the priority initiatives of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, which is a coalition of over 80 environmental organizations around the state. You'll hear from some subject matter experts after me, but I wanted to emphasize a couple points going forward. Minnesota is projected to add about 1.3 million new people by 2030. This bill is really about what kind of policy framework Minnesota develops to incorporate that growth in a way that sustains our environment, increases our competitiveness, and adds value to our communities. These people, many of whom, of course, will be our kids and grandkids, are going to be our next generation's entrepreneurs, business leaders, and cultural pioneers. What we don't want to do is add that amount of people based on last century's model of cheap gas and cheap energy, because we know the era of cheap gas is waning, but less well known is how the demographics of the state are changing as well. Minnesota, like the rest of the country, is becoming older. Demographers refer to this as the silver tsunami. The senior population is the fastest growing segment of the population. Recent projections are that by 2020, there'll be more people in Minnesota over 65 than in the current K-12 education system. To put this in perspective, in 1960, just about 50% of households were two parents with children, and now that is only 23% of households. Families are having fewer children, and a growing number of households are choosing to not have children at all. I mention all this because this change in demographics is shifting consumer preferences towards communities where people have greater choices in where they live and how they move around. And this point is where we have a really great and important win-win with achieving our climate change goals, because by meeting that growing market demand, we can also take an important step to lowering our greenhouse gas emissions as well. You'll hear more from a professor at the university later on about this connection between land use, vehicle miles traveled, and global warming, but I'll just give you a quick primer. Patterns of development, where and how we grow, have enormous consequences for energy use and climate change. Simply put, our growth in driving is driving up greenhouse gas emissions. Research from the MCAG process demonstrated conclusively that communities that offer people more transportation choices, which is simply where it is safe and convenient to take transit, walk, bike, or simply drive shorter distances, were critical to meeting the state's global warming reduction goals. The MCAG unanimously adopted the recommendation to, quote, improve land use planning and development practices to target growth in ways that reduce the number and length of vehicle trips. To date, much of the conversation about global warming solutions in the transportation sector has focused on technological advances such as new vehicle technologies and alternative fuels. While these strategies are critical and must be pursued, the projected growth in driving will overwhelm these efforts. The crux of the issue, as we all have experience in every day, is that we have built communities over the last half century that have given us little choice. They have largely required us to drive to just about every trip, getting a gallon of milk, dropping off the kids at school, picking up the kids at hockey practice, and even going to the neighborhood park. In fact, while we often think of our commute to work when we think about traffic and congestion, that is actually only 15% of the trips we take every day. 85% of the time that we pick up our car keys is for these mundane day-to-day trips, and it's those kind of trips that are a direct result of our land use patterns. The good news is that changes in land use do not require technological breakthroughs or massive infrastructure investments. They can result in big cost savings. A recent national study by the Urban Land Institute, a real estate industry research institution, suggests that modest changes in land use, such as mixing uses, pedestrian-friendly design, and more compact development, can reduce driving by 20 to 40%. This is because when people live in neighborhoods where cars are not the only transportation option, they drive a third fewer miles in neighborhoods where driving is not the only way to get around. That's a global warming connection, and we'll hear more about that later, but I want to talk to you briefly about the other environmental and economic benefits that go along with this legislation. First of all, public infrastructure cost savings. More compact communities cost the public sector far less in the long term than more spread out communities through more efficient use of infrastructure. According to a Metropolitan Council study, a more compact development form, which would give people the opportunity to walk more, rely more on transit, and generally just drive shorter distances, could save $3 billion in infrastructure costs over 20 years. Personal transportation costs. This is intuitive, but it bears repeating when we think of our current economic condition. Transportation has been steadily grabbing a larger and larger share of our household budgets. It is now the second largest expense behind only a mortgage. This burden is far greater, of course, in communities with little transportation choices, and it'll only be exacerbated by rising fuel prices. This is why most people that deal in workforce housing recognize access to transportation as integral to any meaningful definition of affordability. And finally, there's all the other really important environmental benefits that go for this type of policy framework, such as improved air and water quality and the preservation of valuable farmland in Minnesota. As residential growth spreads into agricultural communities, inevitably we lose farms and farmers, losing not only a part of Minnesota's heritage, but also a critical part of Minnesota's economy. I had the privilege of serving on the statewide conservation plan, one of their land use advisory groups. This was the LCCMR-funded study that I'm sure you all heard about. And again, that study came, that was like the MCAG process, group of business leaders, university professors, environmental organizations, supporting the need to, over time, reduce our per capita growth in driving as well. In conclusion, at the beginning of my testimony, I mentioned the projected growth in Minnesota's population. I'll leave you with one final stat. 50% of the development on the ground by 2050 will be built between now and then. This provides an enormous opportunity for us to rethink the public and private costs and benefits of our transportation investments and land use policies. What this bill does is set the policy framework moving forward that is informed by the emerging new realities of rising and erratic energy prices, climate change, and changing demographics and shifting consumer preferences. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have Julian Marshall here from the University of Minnesota who's going to share some of the highlights of a study that supported the findings and recommendations of the Climate Change Advisory Group that was done at the University of Minnesota. That talks about the transportation, climate change, connection, and how land use informs that. I just wanted to mention, and he probably will himself, two of the key findings were that the transportation sector in Minnesota can meet its share of Minnesota's greenhouse gas emission goals in 2015 and can exceed them in 2025 using a combination of strategies. And it finds that comprehensive action is needed sooner, not later. I think you have a copy of this in your packet.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. I'm Julian Marshall. I'm a professor of environmental engineering in the civil engineering department at University of Minnesota. And I also hold an appointment in urban and regional planning at the Humphrey Institute. I'm up here on behalf of myself and also two of my colleagues, Lori McGinnis from the Center for Transportation Studies and Carissa Shively-Slaughterback from the Humphrey Institute.
Try moving your projector back. Would that help? Or
closer.
Closer.
Try that. Is that okay?
Now move the mic close to you, too.
Mic.
The mic. Is that better? So I have a brief presentation. I wanted to start with a couple of items before getting into the meat of it. One is just to say a result from the scholarly literature that urban form influences vehicle miles traveled, or in this case, vehicle kilometers traveled. This chart shows one example of that. Each dot up here is a city in the U.S. On the y-axis is vehicle kilometers traveled, that is distance per person per day on average. And on the x-axis is the urban population density. You can see there's a fair amount of scatter in these data, and there's also a general downward trend that in denser cities, people need to drive less distance each day to get to where they're going, to work, to shop, and to whatnot. This is just meant to be illustrative. There are several other examples. In fact, a recent review cited over 100 peer-reviewed journal articles saying what we know intuitively to be true, that the way a city is built influences how we interact with that built environment and with the transportation infrastructure. For example, if there's greater availability of alternative modes of busing and bicycle lanes, then people are more likely to use them, not surprisingly. I want to point to a couple of news items on solutions. One is from one of my favorite news sources, The Onion. I hope everybody's familiar with The Onion. Here's a scientific survey that they did several years ago, and they found that 98% of U.S. commuters favor public transportation for others. They point out a slogan to try to increase bus ridership, which is, "Take the bus, I'll be glad you did." So this is one view of public transportation, how people interact with it. This is from the year 2000. Let me fast forward a little bit to an updated view, perhaps. This is from Minnesota Public Radio in December of 2008, citing the surprise at the high ridership rates on mass transit and other alternative modes, including carpooling and bicycling, which were surprising, not only in of themselves, but also because this was in winter, when some of those modes would be less convenient. And also, this was after the gasoline prices had dropped back down. And they point that at Metro Transit, bus and train ridership has stayed at its highest level in 25 years. I believe there was another article more recently that said this trend has continued. Moving on to my presentation, I flipped it on its head. I'm going to start with our conclusions and then tell you how I got there. And these two conclusions are the first two conclusions in the brochure that you have. One is that our state can meet our greenhouse gas emission reduction goals using three approaches: changes to vehicles, changes to fuels, and changes to land use and vehicle miles traveled. And our main conclusion there was that we need to do all three. If we attempt to do only two of these three, we won't hit our goals, most likely. And then the second point is that meeting our goals requires starting sooner rather than later. So let me tell you a little bit about how we reached that goal. This study was funded by the legislature. There were several participants over at the University of Minnesota, including myself in civil engineering, Lori McGinnis, I already mentioned, from the Center of Transportation Studies, researchers in mechanical engineering, and then the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs. In addition, we had assistance and support from folks here in the legislature, including representatives Melissa Portman and Frank Hornstein, and several people in the agencies who helped by providing data, providing feedback as we went along the process. And then finally, we enlisted the help of experts from around the country, including flying them here to discuss our research and how it was going and get their feedback. So we really had a large team that was working on this project. So here are the reduction goals as proposed by the governor and passed by this legislature. The reduction targets are to reduce relative to year 2005 emissions by 15% by the year 2015, and so on, 30% by 2025 and 80% by 2050. The legislation as passed didn't specify how that would be broken down by sector, for example, transportation versus electricity. So in doing our study, we just assumed that those percent reductions would also need to come from the transportation sector. So could the transportation sector reduce their emissions by 15% by 2015, and so on? I mentioned the three core areas we focused on: vehicles, fuels, and land use. For today, I'm going to focus exclusively on the last issue, land use, since that's relevant to the legislation that's being discussed here. And I'm focusing exclusively for today on on-road gasoline vehicles, which is the majority of transportation greenhouse gas emissions. We used a model to look at how emissions would change over time into the future depending on specific policies that were adopted. And this slide attempts to represent kind of the guts of the model, the calculations that we were doing. So we looked at the emissions from transportation as the product of three terms. The first term represents fuel consumption per vehicle, so that would be in gallons per mile. That's the reciprocal of miles per gallon, which we're quite used to thinking about for comparing vehicles. The second term gets to fuels, which is the carbon content of the fuel in amount of carbon per gallon of gasoline or alternative fuel. And then the last term is the vehicle activity or vehicle miles traveled. And so you can see we have all three items up there represented in this equation. And again, for today, I'll focus on the last one. So I guess to emphasize the importance of that last term, let me show you one set of model runs that we did. This is showing over time on the x-axis from 1980 until today, present in the solid line, and then projections out into the future, the three colored lines out to 2030. And then on the y-axis is vehicle miles traveled in Minnesota. And you'll notice that historically over time, there's been a rise in vehicle miles traveled up until the past few years when it's flattened out. And so that's makes forecasts into the future somewhat challenging. And so when we ask people within the state government what are a range of possibilities for the future, these are the three numbers that we were given and that we use. So the lowest line there assumes no growth in vehicle miles traveled over time. That's just a continuation of the trends from the past few years. The next line up, the blue one, shows medium growth, 0.9% increase per year. That's roughly the growth in population over time. So this would assume that approximately there's no growth in vehicle miles traveled per person over time. And then the third scenario, the high growth scenario, 2.3% increase over time. So that would assume that population is growing and also vehicle miles traveled per person continues to grow over time. So when we include these three scenarios as inputs to the model, the outputs that we see are presented here. These are our emissions over time, the same three scenarios, high, medium, and low vehicle miles traveled. And then you can see the targets that we're trying to reach, the 2015 target and the 2025 target. Now, in these scenarios, we assumed improvements in vehicles, which is the CAFE standards, which will be tightened over time. And we also assumed improvements in fuels, a low carbon fuel standard. So those two portions are already included here, and what we're looking at is just the role of vehicle miles traveled. What you can see is that it makes a big difference. That is, those three different scenarios turn out quite differently in our emissions projections. And also, it's really only the lowest of those three lines that meet the goal. So our conclusion from this is that we have to include land use issues on the table. That is, we need all three issues if we want to meet our objectives. So again, our conclusions, we looked at three ways we might go about meeting those goals: changes to vehicles, fuels, and land use / vehicle miles traveled. We have to do all three. That was a clear conclusion from the many model runs we did. I showed you an example of a few scenarios, and we have to begin starting now. Greenhouse gas emission reductions is one important goal among many, and so I think it's fair to say that our goals for shifts in land use planning would account for many other goals as well. Just to pull out one example, because I saw that increased bicycle riding and walking is one of several goals that are in here, and of course that speaks to not only greenhouse gas emissions but also to air quality, and there are public health benefits from greater opportunities for exercise on a daily basis. Many of these goals are summarized in the land use literature as the three Ds. They are density, design, and diversity, which is to say, as you've heard earlier, allowing people greater choice in where they choose to live and work. So with that, I'll conclude. Thanks very much. What you have in front of you is a summary of our greater report. There's a website listed on the last page, which I have listed up here in case people would like more of the details from our research. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Lots of detail there. Are there questions for the witness? Okay. Next witness, Senator Dibble.
Thank you.
Chair, we have Chuck Dayton.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Charles Dayton. I'm a volunteer for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And in a sense, I'm sort of standing in for Will Steger, who would have been here today if he weren't off in Michigan giving a talk. And what he would have done, I think, would have been to address some of the major scientific information we have about changes in climate since the IPCC report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, issued its last report in 2007. I also have an interest in the environmental review process, having been involved in that from the beginning when it passed, and has and having been involved in a number of pieces of litigation that that involve that statute. A report that was issued in December during the Bush administration by the U.S. Climate Change Science Program addressed four potential kinds of abrupt or almost catastrophic potential climate changes that, could occur and had been talked about in the literature. One was sea level rise, and the IPCC report did not predict a dramatic increase in sea level rise, but the models of the IPCC did not take into account the activities and the dynamics of glaciers as they're affected by temperature. And what this report by the U.S. Climate Change Science Program, which sort of ties together all the federal activities on climate, noted was that glaciers react to melting in a very dramatic and dynamic way. That is, that as the meltwater goes through the glacier and down to the bedrock, it lubricates the bottom of the glacier and causes it to move faster, so that in Greenland and Antarctica we've been seeing evidence of this. And so the prediction is that as this phenomenon occurs and as ice shelves are broken up by warming and rising sea levels, that we'll begin to see sea level increases far beyond those that have been predicted in the IPCC report. And James Hansen, who is the head climate scientist at NASA, said the models don't predict this, but if you look at what the sea levels were the last time the climate was 3 degrees above the background, sea levels were about 25 meters higher than they are now. That's 80 feet. So there is a potential catastrophic kind of impact. The realistic impacts are more like 6 feet by the end of the century, which is in itself catastrophic to a lot of people. So I only emphasize this, and what Will would talk about is the areas of the Arctic that he's been on that are no longer there, that he's traveled on these places that are just water now, and that there's been a dramatic decrease in the size of the Arctic ice. The second catastrophic impact is a potential of drying in the southwestern part of North America due to changes in global temperature and sea temperature, and that looks likely to happen as a result of increasing sea temperature. We may be seeing a harbinger of that kind of effect now in southeastern Australia in the Melbourne area, where 200 people have died as a result of some terrible fires. The two things that they don't say are likely that have been talked about as catastrophic impacts are changes in the Gulf Stream. They say that there will probably be a 25 to 30% decrease in the strength of the Gulf Stream, but they don't think that a total collapse of the Gulf Stream is likely. And The other catastrophic impact that they don't think is likely that you hear about in the literature is a methane burp, a melting of permafrost and the deep concentrations of methane in the seafloor. They think that there will be huge increases in methane release, but that the kind of catastrophic release that resulted in the extinction of a major portion of life on the planet about 250 million years ago isn't likely, but they say it can't be discounted. The other scientific new information is that the change in carbon concentration, which has gone from about 280 parts per million to 380 parts per million since the Industrial Revolution, is increasing. The curve is becoming more steep rather than leveling out. And one of the things that the Climate Change Advisory Group report says that it's increasing about twice as fast in Minnesota as it is nationally. Why that is, I don't know, but that's what the report predicted. The Climate Change Advisory Group recommendation was to include greenhouse gas emissions in the environmental review process when an environmental assessment worksheet is done or when an environmental impact statement is done, and that is Section 4 of the bill. It doesn't increase the number or change the number of EAWs and EISs that are being done. It just recognizes that greenhouse gas emissions are an environmental impact and should be examined in the context of environmental review. Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Dayton, for that report. Question I would have then, if the IPCC puts out their report, I'm assuming that those that have discovered the glacier melts as well as the overheating issues you talked about, the tragedy fires that killed a bunch of people in the southern region of the world, have they not been reported to the IPCC? And if not, why? Or why wouldn't they, if they were so catastrophic, be included in that report?
Mr. Dayton.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the IPCC report is issued every 5 years, and it's a long process involving thousands of people and all kinds of back-and-forth discussions. So this is an interim. This is data that the IPCC did not feel was solid enough, I guess, to include in its models. And what the U.S. Climate Change Study Group took all the information, about 30 scientists from 15 agencies, and studied it for 2 years after the IPCC report came out. And this is their conclusion. I expect that when the next IPCC report comes out, that this information will be in the models.
Follow-up?
Just a follow-up, please. And when will that be? When will that report be out for public view?
Mr. Dayton?
You know?
I don't know the date. I assume it's 2012.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Dibble, you had one more person.
One more person. Bowser is here. They can respond. They're available to respond. You don't necessarily need to testify to the wetland piece. But we do have Molly Brown from Callister College. Would like to share thoughts as a student and a citizen.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Chaudhry, Senator DeBull, and committee members, thank you for your time. My name is Molly Brown again, and I came from New Hampshire to study at McAllister College. I'm soon to graduate and thinking more and more about where I want to settle after school, and some of the main factors I'm considering our transit options, the economy, a clean environment, and open spaces. Last semester, I studied abroad in Nicaragua. Managua, the capital city, is poorly planned and entirely unwalkable. There is public transit, but it's completely inefficient. Coming back here to Minnesota, it's all the more clear to me what an incredible opportunity we have. Communities need healthy, reliable transportation options that make it possible for everyone to thrive while still supporting environmental sustainability. The Minnesota of 2020, 2030, and 2050, the Minnesota I want to live in, will need to be healthy, livable, and sensibly built. In supporting this bill, you can make sure that as a state, we move in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we move on to some of the other witnesses, did anyone want to ask any questions of Bowser at the moment? They are still here. We can bring them up if questions do pop up.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess Bowser does want to testify.
Oh, okay.
We have Julie.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Julie Clocker. I am the Assistant Director for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. And I just have a couple of comments on the first part about basically our WACA rules. We at Bowser, obviously, we are fully in support of making sure that we understand carbon sequestration benefits, not only of wetlands, but really all of our practices. And we are putting in lots of buffer strips and CRP and all types of activities that also affect carbon sequestration, and we are very much working in that direction. We have been working on pollution reduction calculators, and many of you are familiar with our E-Link reporting system, and that reports on the types of pollution reductions we're doing on each one of these practices. Mostly right now it's been phosphorus reduction and sediment reduction. We are working on a calculator which helps us figure out carbon sequestration benefits that we receive from all of our practices. So that's one of the things that we're going to look at agency-wide, implementing our online calculators for all of our local governments of local governmental units that are working on conservation. So we're fully supportive of all of this. I have just one little slight concern, and that's only about the rulemaking process and what it means for this. We are just completing a two-year emergency rulemaking process, and that's going to come out in the State Register for public noticing in the next several weeks. And I'm not sure, honestly, based on what this says here, if that would mean we'd have to put the rulemaking process on hold and roll the carbon sequestration impacts into that rulemaking process, in which case it would extend that longer, or if there's some kind of nimble way we can work it into legislation that says that, yes, it's important and we are going to consider it, but maybe it's not in the rule. It's actually just a broader Bowser concern for all of our programs, not just our Wetland Conservation Act, but our restoration of wetlands and all of those types of concerns. So we're fully supportive. I just want to make sure we don't throw our emergency rule process off track. We have to have them in place by August, or we revert to 2007 rules.
Senator Dibble, is it okay if we make sure this is crafted so that the current rulemaking is not delayed? Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Questions for the witness? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, and the next person we have on the agenda is Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this piece of legislation and the opportunity to work with Senator Dibble on the legislation. I think this is obviously an important issue. We have a lot of goals for greenhouse gas emission reduction. We know that vehicle miles traveled are a significant part of that. In fact, cities are supporting legislation this session to address vehicle miles traveled through land use planning that hopefully you'll get to talk about sometime at a future meeting. But we also are doing a lot of work to address greenhouse gas emission reduction, energy efficiency, environmental protection, and preserving ag land and open spaces through land use practices, and by concentrating residential, commercial, and industrial developments in areas that are already urbanized. As specific to the bill, there are two parts of it that I would like to address a couple concerns with. One part I'd like to support in particular. So start with the concerns. The environmental review section, which is section 4, it's found on page 3 of the bill, lines 16 through 27. This would add greenhouse gas alternatives and mitigation requirements to all forms of environmental review, including environmental assessment worksheets, environmental impact statements, and AUARs, alternative urban area reviews, or any other form of environmental review. Environmental assessment worksheets are a very, very common document. They're required for anything that disturbs land of more than an acre in size. Almost every development that happens in some way needs an EAW these days. and we are concerned about the amount of additional staff time it would take to process those environmental reviews. The permits cannot be given for construction until an environmental review has been completed and approved. And we do think that this would take a significant amount more, both of staff time to process and make sure it was an adequate review, and of consulting time, because obviously most city staff are not experts on mitigation of vehicle miles traveled and greenhouse gas emissions. We would have to hire that out, especially in greater Minnesota. Those resources could be fairly scarce, and we might have to wait quite a while before we had access to them. I do think that if environmental assessment worksheets were removed from this, this is definitely an appropriate level of review for a more comprehensive look at environmental impacts, like an environmental impact statement where you're looking at cumulative environmental impacts for a significant project. I think it fits very well within the guidelines of what we should be looking at in those types of projects. So, second area I would obviously like to make some comments on is Section 12 of the bill on page 8. Deals with the changes required to comprehensive plans. You appreciate the A1 amendment that you adopted allows the work in subdivision 1 of this, so the establishing of a baseline of vehicle miles traveled. The work local governments have to do to establish those numbers would be able to use funds from the Metro Livable Communities Fund. That is not where most of the costs on this is going to come in, however. The costs are going to, for local governments, are going to come in under the rest of this section. Revising of a comprehensive plan is a significant action that requires many hearings, a lot of public notice, a lot of staff time, and then, of course, the actual big part of the work is amending all of your ordinances once your comp plan has been changed to be consistent.
Sure. The goal of my amendment was to allow for the expenses that Mr. Johnson is describing, make that an allowable use of the Livable Communities grant or Livable Communities Fund. I think that's how it was drafted, but I'll look to council to help me. It wasn't just intended for the University of Minnesota's technical assistance. It was also to allow municipalities to apply for those funds for the additional expense that they are going to be put to in order to update their comp plans.
Yeah, the amendment said expenses related to this subdivision, and maybe you want to think about changing subdivision to section. Would that make a difference, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, it would. I don't know the balance of the Livable Communities Fund. I don't know how easy it is for communities to access it. The amendment language did say subject to existing guidelines for use of that money, and I did not have time to look at those from when I saw the amendment. But I was more than happy to work with the author on the wording of that language. I'm not concerned about that. Appreciate the effort to deal with our fiscal impacts.
Thank you for flagging that.
And Mr. Chair, the last thing I just want to point out is the staff time and legal time of the ordinance work following the amendment of the comp plan is very significant. I don't know that that would fall under the category of something that would be allowable under this. But obviously making legal changes to ordinance requires very significant public process, and it has to be done perfectly or you end up with lawsuits. So I would like to point out that on page 3, section 3, establishes a new community sustainable communities grants program that I actually think is very badly needed, and I appreciate the effort to get this underway. We have a number of cities in the state that have been working voluntarily with their own resources where they can scrape them together to try and come up with conservation design ordinances, with other creative ways of improving the open spaces and the preservation of those within their communities and reducing vehicle miles traveled. They don't have the resources to do that, and even that's even more the case now. But even the state agencies that have been working with them are becoming very strapped in their abilities to assist. So I think this would be very helpful in terms of helping communities come up with new ways to address these important issues. That's the conclusion of my comments, Mr. Chair. Be happy to sit for any questions.
Questions for the witness? Senator Dill and then Ingebrigtsen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, when are we going to do amendments? Can we do them now, or do we wait?
We have one more witness. Is there a Todd Olson that wants to testify as well? Why don't we go through all the witnesses, then we can get to the discussion. Senator Gabritzen?
Is that what you wish to do, or do you want me to ask questions now, Mr. Chair?
As long as the witness is here, why don't you go ahead and ask them questions?
Certainly. I'm just somewhat confused, and maybe Senator Dibble can answer this as well as the League of Cities, but the funding sources for this now, there's going to be some dollars. Obviously, we're talking about grants that are available. You talk about cities that are on board with this. Are all cities in Minnesota on board with this? Would be one question. And where is exactly the funding coming from to refresh my memory?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, this is not a policy every city in the state has chosen to adopt. It's being done purely on a voluntary nature. The cities I know that are working on it are all kind of in the collar area around the metro that are expecting, once the economy picks back up, that they will see a lot of pressure for growth in their communities, and they're trying to be ready for that. Some of them are very small communities now that are expecting to more than double in size in the next 15 years or so. And an important thing to keep note of in this bill is the comp plan changes are for the metropolitan area, but the environmental review changes are statewide. The concern I mentioned about how much work would be required for environmental review is a change for all environmental review done anywhere in the state. The changes for comp planning and ordinances involved with that are only in the metropolitan area.
Just to follow up with that, then, if I could, so that's being funded by the metropolitan area, then. Rural Minnesota is not paying for that particular fund. Is that correct?
Right, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you.
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question follows a little bit along Senator Ingebrigtsen's. The scope of the legislation, does it apply when they use the term local governments? Does that apply to all cities across the state, or is there a definition of class size for cities, or is it all encompassing?
Mr. Chair, we're section. Mr. Senator Stumpf, what are you looking at?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I was just wondering, the scope and application of the legislation, it says various state agencies and local governments are referenced. I was just wondering, you know, to what extent who does this totally apply to?
Depends on which part of the bill. Different parts of the bill apply differently. So, for example, the comp plan update to consider reducing greenhouse gases and vehicle miles traveled, that applies to the municipalities in the metropolitan area. The Sensible Communities Grant Program, that's for municipalities that have land use authority who want to make changes on a voluntary basis to their zoning requirements throughout the state. So that's not a requirement. That's a voluntary activity. The environmental analysis, the assessments, the impact statements, the area-wide urban reviews. Or urban area reviews, that's whoever is the responsible governmental unit for whatever that project or proposal is. And of course, there's schools, which you'd be interested in, citing schools. That's actually a good thing. Allow school districts to save money. So does that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, it does to some degree, but I under the current statutes, authorities for different levels of cities have different levels of authority. So I was just wondering if the cities, let's say, at the lowest bottom of the rung, size-wise, is there a distinction in what they have to do versus, let's say, the cities of the first class or the cities of?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, we're not asking cities outside of the metropolitan area to do anything specific. in terms of their comprehensive planning or their zoning. So you know, unless they want to do it voluntarily, then they could apply to this voluntary to this grant program on a competitive basis. So we're not making distinctions between townships or cities of the first class because we're not asking cities outside the metropolitan area. And we're not doing anything differently within the metropolitan area than we do now. It's all, you know, it's the normal comprehensive planning process that we're amending. So we have kind of a standard for municipalities within the metropolitan area who has to do comp plans and submit them to the Metropolitan Council for review and aggregation. So we're not changing that threshold.
Cities outside the metro are not going to have to start doing a comprehensive plan now under his bill.
Unless they want to.
Unless they want to, and then there's funding available for that under his bill. Senator Parcell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dibble, you aren't asking cities outside the metro area to be a part of it or to require it of them. But you do require, I mean, it is required inside the metro area for townships to do it. Sounds to me like you're including the townships in the metro area.
Senator Dibble?
Metro 7.
Yeah. I would need some advice, but we're not...
We are doing them now in the townships, in the metro area.
Yeah, whatever is currently the case, absolutely. But we're making
resources available. So you're going to impose a bunch of new regulations on mileage and all that jazz and every other kind of thing that is not on them today, but they're going to have to do it in the future?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We're also allowing them to apply for some resources to do that.
The rest of the state, then.
Mr. Johnson, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, I wanted to add one comment in response to Senator Stump's question, just to be clear that the one place where a smaller non-metro city is being required to do something new is if they are the responsible government unit for an environmental review, they would have to address greenhouse gas emissions as part of that now under this legislation. That's the difference. So some very small communities choose not to ever put themselves in that role. They would have the county or someone else be the RGU for the environmental review. That depends on the city. But that's the one new requirement outside the metro area.
But it's not saying that the bill's not saying that more cities have to do the environmental worksheet. It's just saying those that are already doing them have to consider greenhouse gases.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Let's move to the witnesses, and then we'll get the committee exchange. And I apologize. We do have Annalie Garlitz from the counties will also be testifying. If you'd like to come to the table while Mr. Olson is speaking, that'd be fine. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Todd Olson. I represent Metropolitan Cities. The boundaries of our organization coincide with the boundaries of the Met Council, so it's our members that are the communities that are required to do comp plans under law. And our concern today is in the reopening of the comp plans. I'll just echo what Mr. Johnson said. We have concerns with the reopening of that. Our member cities just turned in their comp plans a few weeks ago, culminating a 1 to 2 year process of intensive staff time usage and public hearings. And while we are still investigating the depth required to include a vehicle miles traveled reduction in our comp plans, any reopening of a comp plan after completion is a major undertaking, and we want to continue to work with Senator Dibble to address these concerns.
How often are cities required to update their comprehensive plans?
Every 10 years. The last one was in 1998, and the next one will be in 2018.
Okay.
The process begins with the collection of the census data, but the real work is done in the last 1 to 2 years when they start doing the public hearings.
I think there's a little dust off that they do every 5 years or so. There's a shorter, smaller little check-in midway. And Mr. Chair, we have the unfortunate circumstances of timing, which I acknowledge. We've just now gotten rolling on addressing climate change issues, and you know the climate change advisory group report was just turned in a short time ago, and you know made an array of recommendations, about 46 recommendations across all sectors of activity within Minnesota. this is one of the absolute number one top key findings that we absolutely have to address the transportation sector and in that the land use connection. So we do have an unfortunate circumstance of timing to wait 10 years. It means we can't do the things that that called for in this report.
Mr. Olson, what's this dust off update that's required every 5 years?
I know cities can update their plan at any time. I'm not.
But I understand there's every few years there's some, maybe
check up to make sure they're following.
Maybe I'm just responding to some individual cities that I'm aware of that do that on a more timely basis than every 10 years.
Okay.
I don't know if that's mandated by the council or not.
I'll double check for you.
That would be helpful. Welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I also work with the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators. I would like to start out by saying that we were very appreciative to see the inclusion in here in Section 3 for the Sensible Communities Grant Program. This is the need for more assistance for planning and zoning comp plans has been something that counties have been talking about our need for this for several years now. We've been in many discussions with Senator Dill about this and others about the need to have more education, more monetary assistance to help some of these counties and areas that might not have the expertise or the staff available to help them do plans on different levels than they're doing right now to look at some of these other issues. So as always, we're open to talking about different ways to have more education or grants available to local units of government to do more planning in areas of the state. Relating to other areas of the bill, AMC does have some concerns that this bill could result in some costs to counties. As Mr. Johnson stated, the greenhouse gas section is Section 4, where it talks about EAWs, EISs, and AUARs. This is something that takes a significant amount of county staff time. And as Mr. Johnson noted, this is an added duty to local units of government to analyze the cumulative impact of greenhouse gases, and it would certainly add to costs and it would certainly contribute to added costs and probably larger delays for projects, and has the potential to add significant staff time to the review of different AUARs, EISs, and EAWs that come through the county. It is very likely that counties would have to hire consultants because the level of expertise that many counties, particularly if they have one staff person, that's also the solid waste person and the planning and zoning person and maybe the septic person, to also take a look at this particular issue and be able to analyze greenhouse gas cumulative impacts is something that I don't know if is on the level of something some of the staff in areas of the state can do. So it's likely that we would hire somebody to come in and take a consultant to do that work. Because if it also leaves counties open to liability
for doing a worksheet,
the analysis on the EAWs, EISs,
on the work.
And, yes.
Well, there's worksheets and then there's EISs.
Yes.
Are you more concerned about the worksheet because those are kind of more common practice with internal staff?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Is it, if generally in generally if an EIS is being done, is that normally hired out anyway?
That's correct.
All right.
Mr.
Further
Chair,
comments?
The other section in here that we're in this bill that we're looking at is Section 12 about the vehicle miles traveled, and I was able to have some email correspondence with Carver County earlier today about their comp plan that they recently are in the process of getting approved by Met Council. And they did have some concerns about opening the process back up and doing an amendment. And without knowing if this would be a minor or a major amendment, from their review of this, they were thinking that it could potentially result in a major amendment of their comprehensive plan, and they did have some concerns about the level of expertise needed by the county to be able to complete that amendment to the comp plan, and then also what those costs would be to obtain that level of expertise to complete this project.
Do counties do comprehensive planning?
That's correct.
Are they required to do?
Carver County, and I was trying to check the other counties. I'm thinking maybe Scott County. But Carver County certainly did have to do one as part of this.
As part of what?
As part of the Met Council comprehensive plan updates.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dibble, does... is this the same issue as with the cities, those that are currently required to do comprehensive plans would have to update theirs with these, the transportation vehicle miles things?
Mr. Chairman, to that point.
And that would apply to the metropolitan counties.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, to that point.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, the counties are the planning agency for townships, and the counties that were talked about have a large number of townships. Unless townships have urban town powers, generally the county is the planning entity for the four townships. And Scott and Carver have both got a lot of townships.
Yeah.
So they are the ones that... that planning.
But this would bring in the comprehensive planning aspect part of Senator Dibble's bill would affect two counties, Scott and Carver. Are there any others that would be affected?
Mr. Chair, I wasn't able to check with all of the counties. I was only able to hear from Carver County this morning.
Okay.
So my understanding that, and I apologize for not finding the details on this, but I do know Carver County has just completed their plan to be sent in for review. I don't know if all counties in the metro area have to do that review based on the cities. If all of the cities in their area are doing this, I do have to follow up on that, and that wasn't something.
That would be helpful to know. Then on the same topic, do they do it every 10 years as well, like the cities? Are you aware of this question about whether there's some sort of update that's done every 5 years or at least prior to the 10 years? Is there anything there?
Mr. Chair, members, I do know that my previous life as a comp plan writer, I do know that it was often worked into comprehensive plans, that it's very common to review them every few years, to revisit them, make sure things haven't changed. I don't know if it's a requirement of... Mm-hmm.
Sure, I might have just made that up. I just know that I know that a lot of municipalities on a more regular basis than every 10 years.
Yes.
10 years is a long time.
I was just wondering if there's any triggering mechanism that requires some sort of
Mr. Chairman
perennial review.
Can I answer that one,
Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think the things that trigger changes in comprehensive plans are if there are proposals that come to the city for urban services and development in an area that is not within the metropolitan urban service area, the MUSA line, and they can bring requests to the Metropolitan Council, which they can either approve or deny. So there are opportunities to amend the comprehensive plan that are within that time frame, because 10 years out, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, right now, I think a lot of cities, looking at the housing and the demand for growth, are probably very conservative on any requests, in some areas making no change for the next 10 years, and yet that could change. And so then I think there isn't a hard line that they cannot seek amendment to that.
Right. Mr. Johnson, how likely would it be that now that many cities are completing their comprehensive plans this year, how likely is it that some would voluntarily update their comprehensive plans in a year or two?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would expect it would be very unlikely that they would do it that soon.
Mm-hmm.
The normal times a comprehensive plan is taken out before the 10 years are if the community either has a very well-staffed planning department that might do a triennial review or an every 5 year, you know, a midpoint review, something like that, or if there's a significant proposal that comes in that would require a change in the comprehensive plan for that proposal to move forward, they would then look at that and determine whether a variance or a change to the comp plan was the right route to go.
Or if some resources became available.
Mr. Chair, potentially, although the process for comp planning is lengthy. It requires the planning commissions to do lots of work, lots of public meetings, depending on what's being changed. Most cities have a number of other citizen groups, appointed boards and councils that would process recommendations, bring those up to the planning committee, which would then bring them to the city council, and then that would go to the Met Council for approval and then back to the city for final approval. So it's a lengthy process that most cities wouldn't do just for the fun of seeing if they were still on track after a couple of years. It would have to be for a pretty large purpose. And we've had cities do them, comp plan changes during the mid-course. But it would normally be, especially for communities that are not seeing a lot of changes in land use, it would be something they would take out for the 10-year review.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if it's for you, Senator Dibble, or the League of Cities, but my understanding is this is a pretty comprehensive plan that cities are required to do for the Met Council currently. I'm not sure how much of this is incorporated in their requirements and if it requires a whole redo or just an amendment to those current requirements by the Met Council.
This bill doesn't require a whole reopening of
Chair and Senator Kielash, what it would require is whatever changes the Met Council makes to their land use plan, the local comprehensive plans have to be amended to match that, and then local ordinances have to be amended or changed to be consistent with both of those comprehensive plans. But depending what they decide the changes are that are needed will determine how broad it is. We had a chance just today to bounce this off of a couple of cities, kind of said it between, you know, low, medium, high expense, what would this take to do? And the response we got from two cities, from the cities of Hastings and Bloomington, were that it would definitely not be a low-cost project. Changing, like, a single phrase in a comp plan is a fairly low-cost but still time-consumptive. This would be in the medium to high-cost range, depending on how much consulting time was needed.
Mr. Chair, I guess my question was, isn't a lot of this already required in the Met Council's plans, and there's just the addition of the emissions part in that plan at this point? So a lot of this work is already being done by the cities and areas within the metro area. Is that correct, or am I off on that?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kielash, a lot of things, yeah. The Met Council's plan and city comp plans are very broad in the metro area. The defining factor would be what the Met Council decides to change. So if they decide that communities need to prioritize certain types of land use over others, deprioritize certain types of transit or transportation options, center certain types of operations in certain places, residential, high-density development in certain areas, will make all the difference in how much work it is for each community to change their comp plan to be consistent. And frankly, I don't know what Met Council will have to do to meet these requirements. That's going to be up to them.
Senator Dibble, can we find a threshold within the environmental assessment worksheet where these examinations could take place? So I thought, my first thought was, let's just change it from worksheet to EIS. But then again, a lot of large projects just do the work of the EIS within the worksheet itself. And so you wouldn't want to exempt the worksheet. But maybe if there's a threshold when there are times when the worksheet will just be contracted out because it's just a large project and they've just decided to do all of the scoping and such that would go on in the EIS just right there in the worksheet. So I think the worksheet, having the worksheet examine that is appropriate, but not all the worksheets are of that scale. So I'm wondering if there's some sort of threshold we could find within the worksheet. And maybe PCA or EQB could help design that.
Mr. Chair, that I had that same thought. I would be reluctant to eliminate worksheets because worksheets often, you know, give rise. You know, if you're not even looking at that in the worksheet, you might not have the opportunity, if a worksheet gives rise to an EIS, to look at that in an EIS. But reducing some of the thresholds within the EAW process. The considering alternatives and mitigation measures might be too high, too much activity and too much work for what's typically considered under the scope of a worksheet, but maybe consider or document or acknowledge.
Well, no, I mean, and there are sometimes the entire content of the EIS is done. It's just done within the worksheet. That's what, you know, a lot of people complain, well, you didn't do an EIS. Well, you did the entire, sometimes they just go forward and do the entire work of the EIS within the worksheet. And so I think the worksheet should be there, but maybe there's a threshold within the worksheet where these large examinations do need to have climate change and greenhouse gases considerations, but not everyone. That would be kind of tough.
I mean, Mr. Chair, when you're talking about threshold in terms of size of the project that we're looking at or what the project is.
Yeah. Maybe some of the professionals have some suggestions. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the point on the EAW is that both the LMC and the AMC have said that when we're talking about smaller towns, smaller cities, smaller counties, that an EAW, whereas normally would be done in-house, needs to be farmed out too, and so they're the ones that are going to end up with the additional expense. Whereas everybody, just about, or at least rural communities and rural counties, on an EIS would have to have somebody else do it.
Right. But there are times when the worksheet is contracted out too, just because they've decided to do all the scoping just in the worksheet. And just do the work up front. That's the question I had. Maybe we could just find a threshold within the worksheet where you'd have to do it and where you didn't have to do it. Senator Dibble and then Dill.
Mr. Chair, Lord McGinnis came and whispered into my ear at the very same moment I had the exact same thought, which was, and it's also to address Mr. Johnson's concerns about how expensive these comp plan amendments are going to be. Don't forget that we do have the University of Minnesota. We're going to engage the University of Minnesota. That's Section 13, on the last page there. A lot of the technical work may well be done, and so we'll have technical models sitting there on the shelf, ideas with the measurements that are attached to those ideas, the ideas and techniques. So that'll help cities a lot with their comp planning issues, and we maybe insert this idea into that work as well.
Well, your bill is establishing a technical team at the Center for Transportation Studies to help do these.
Yeah, a model for use by local governments and the Met Council to identify best strategies, et cetera.
Okay.
And so we can make sure that. That's also that's for the comp planning work, but we can also make sure that's for the environmental analysis.
All right, Senator Dill, and then maybe we should entertain some motions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Dibble, I'm a co-author on this bill, and the reason I'm on it is because I like the idea of doing more to control urban sprawl, protect open space, preserve ag land, forest land, and so forth. And I've had some initiatives down that line in the past, so. Many of the things you have in here I support. During the time that this meeting began and we got into it a ways, it was drawn to my attention that Section 4, page 3, is a section that applies statewide, which would include all 87 counties and all the feedlots out there that may have to do an EAW and other rural projects that would have to do an EAW, and we'd have to include all these greenhouse gas emissions. And that is a factor that concerns me. So, frankly, I'd like to eliminate Section 4 altogether, or at least not have it apply to outstate Minnesota. But I'm kind of on the verge of offering an amendment here to delete Section 4. And I know, Mr. Chairman, you're trying to find some middle ground in Section 4.
I'm just thinking out loud on how, I mean, I think the concerns cited by the counties and cities is valid. So I was just exploring out loud how we could allay those concerns.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one way would be to delete the section and worry about that later.
Yeah. Well, then the authors can have a concern.
Mr. Chair, it is another recommendation of the Climate Change Advisory Group that we deal with. Start dealing with and assessing and analyzing and considering climate change gases when we're looking at all the other issues, when we're doing these environmental assessments or analyses on stuff, activities and projects around the state. So, to not do that, I think, would not be a wise way to proceed. We have to start grappling with this question, when we're going to be doing stuff, building things and or changing things, what are the implications for our climate? And, where else but in the environmental analysis?
Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, we're in a recession. Maybe it's a depression. And I don't think it's really a good time to be adding new costs to businesses or government through regulations or added programs. And this is clearly identified by both the counties and the cities as being a substantial increase in cost. So why not move forward with the bill as you've got to delete this section? And when the economy recovers in 2 or 3 years or so, we can put it back in if we think it's a wise idea at that time. I guess we need to wait and see how cold it is between now and then.
Senator Dill, what about just on line 18 and 19, just taking out environmental assessment worksheet and then allowing Senator Dibble to maybe work with some professionals and finding a threshold for that would not be onerous to municipalities? Because it would seem like it was the environmental worksheet that was really troublesome. But like I said, I think there are times when the worksheet is big in scope as well, and so maybe we can find a threshold. But if you're more comfortable, if you're really concerned about it, maybe we can just delete environmental assessment worksheet and just apply it to the EIS, because those are the bigger projects anyway that the municipality will be hiring out contractors and such. And then in the meantime, Senator Dibble can consult some professionals and see if there's a threshold within the worksheet that would not be onerous.
Mr. Chairman?
Just to get a response from Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's certainly an idea that would make it better than the way it is right now, but I'd also wonder if we could, in addition to that, narrow it down to the metro area and provide relief to the countryside. I know I talked to Senator Vickerman about it, and he was thinking about deleting the entire section as well. So it's a point of contention for those of us in rural Minnesota.
Senator Olson and
Mr.
Vickerman.
Chairman, I'm struggling trying to reconcile a number of things here. Senator Dill brought up that, we are in a recession, but we are also the metro area is challenged with trying to maintain some affordability to housing. And many of the things that you're talking about absolutely contribute to a lack of affordability in any development that could occur in their cities.
It's not
And so much of this, you know, you said you didn't want to dictate, you know, the individual choices and behaviors, and yet some of the things that you're talking about, instead of requiring them, a lot of citizens are asking for them. And would our energy be better put to having those kinds of discussions and determining where the people want to go? And just responding to it. The market usually responds to that. I don't, and as Senator Dill said, you know, part of his motivation for being on this was trying to prevent the sprawl, and yet I don't see a section on tax policy. The efforts that were made in terms of changing Green Acres is one of the things that has helped to prevent sprawl, but now trying to take out non-productive acres and tax them higher, those are the very acres that you want to leave with woods and the wetlands and stuff, and now you want to tax them higher. That goes the exact opposite way, particularly in the metro area, to trying to protect this. And the Met Council also has a policy that even in areas, and we've got a lot of areas like that that have some lovely lands that most people would prefer to be preserved so that the trails that go by them, you know, can be have something that they can enjoy and look at. But they require a density that's applied to all the acres, and they won't allow any credit for those that are left open and green. And for encouraging the clustering, unless they, in fact, make them public lands. And the cities resist to making some of that public lands because they don't feel they have the resources to maintain them when the private sector is perfectly willing to do it within a neighborhood. So, you know, there's some other avenues that I think we could do that would contribute to these things without necessarily layering on so much stuff that's going to add so much to the cost that it's going to make it very, very difficult.
Senator Dibble.
The second time I've gotten that today. I was introduced to a whole crowd as Senator Dill this morning. I said I was very proud to be introduced. But I was also accused of authoring a bill of his once, too. Senator Olson, I don't agree that we're adding, we're diminishing the affordability of housing. I think actually through some of these techniques we're potentially adding to the affordability of housing, so I don't see that connection. I also agree with you on your second and third points, and think some of those policy tools are available under a city's planning process, and that's what the University of Minnesota will do. Try to develop some of those techniques, some of those policy tools. Those aren't just zoning and land use regs. Those are different sorts of policies and techniques that cities can use to influence exactly how or to respond to exactly how the market is. So I think, you know, I agree with you and don't think that this bill is at variance with anything that you just said.
But see, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, right now, some of the policies in place within the metro area are the very reason that a lot of the development is jumping outside of the metro area and being free of them. And the market is growing in the counties that are over the line, and those counties would be greatly resistant to being drawn into the Metropolitan Council jurisdiction.
If you are here for Senate File 225, Senator Scheid's bill, we will be rescheduling that bill for another day. Senator Vickerman, thank you for your patience.
I mean, part of this bill looks pretty good, but I'm worried about the agricultural part of it. I wonder if I could ask Mr. Knopf, what would this do? When you start talking about environmental worksheets and all that kind of stuff, rural Minnesota farmers say, now what else are you putting in? Am I reading this right? Does it put a burden on them, or could you tell me?
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Vickerman. Well, the way this works is that for those environmental assessment worksheets or EISs that would have to be done for projects, they would have to consider and evaluate these alternatives and mitigations measures for greenhouse gases. As far as those feedlots under 1,000 animal units, you know, those are exempt from environmental review unless they're in a shoreline or they're in an area like that. So those this wouldn't affect generally, but anything above 1,000 animal units, this would affect greatly. It would be something that they would have to, and basically everything over 1,000 animal units is required to have environmental review done.
Well, on that point, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
On that point, I'm just discussing with Mr. Knopf about who pays for an environmental review, whether, and I know when it's a state environmental assessment that's required by law, the state agency pays a lot of the cost. I mean, the proposer pays some as well, but it's, you know, the PCA puts hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of staff hours into environmental review. So I'm wondering, when it comes to something that would affect a feedlot, for example, it's more the government unit that's going to pay for the cost of that than the farmer? Or is it, how is that cost shared?
Well, Mr. Knopf,
Mr.
feedlot EAWs, the PCA normally does those, or local unit of government? Well,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, the local unit of government, if they're a delegated county, they may get involved in doing the EAW, but generally it's going to be PCA, I think, for most feedlots because of the NPDES permit requirement when you're over 1,000 animal units. At least I think that's right. But the big thing on an EAW, you have to remember, an EIS, the project proposer pays all the costs of conducting the environmental impact statement. But for an environmental assessment worksheet, the agency or the local unit of government is responsible for basically the costs of conducting that environmental review. Now, they can ask the project proposer to have information as part of that review, and then the proposer may have to pay a consultant or somebody to provide information to the city or to the state, who's ever doing it. And many times that happens in an EAW, whereas the project proposer is also required to hire a consultant to do the analysis to give to the agency.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, Mr. Chairman, is there anything that stops the local government from setting their fees to cover that rather than covering it generally? I'd be very surprised if any proposers or developers are getting by without covering those costs.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't know the lay of the land out there as far as cities. I know state agencies don't charge back the costs of an EAW. I know the Pollution Control Agency is looking at that right now as part of their permit fee structure. But generally, they don't. Generally, they unless except for the amount that they have to pay to a consultant for the information. But you know, they could charge as part of the fee to the entity as part of their permit fee. I don't think there's anything that would stop them from that, Senator Olson.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, my experience is that farmers are paying tens of thousands of dollars, $30,000, $40,000, maybe $50,000 for an EAW. It is very costly to them. And in this kind of an economic environment, I don't think we want to add any cost to any business, not just a farm business, but any business out there. And adding this greenhouse gas analysis to a EAW or EIS is something that we definitely should not do in this environment. Maybe when we get rich again in 2 or 3 years, we can consider it. But right now, with the economic climate the way it is, I would like to delete this whole section, Section 4.
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think as Senator Dill's proposal does, when you mentioned that the metropolitan area, I think that it actually is covered under Section 12. It seems like that would be definitely a place to try and see if it works first. The sprawling activity isn't necessarily out in the greater, Minnesota. So maybe if this section does come out, it still will have a very beneficial impact on creating the kind of outcomes that you're looking for. But it seems also, and this isn't exactly speaking to Senator Dill's amendment, but is the greenhouse gas emissions, is that a, are those readily measurable kinds of gases that that we can actually get a handle on. You know, we've talked a lot about carbon dioxide, but you know, are some of these other gases?
Mr. Chair,
measurable? Senator Dibble,
Senator Stubb, you know, it depends, of course. Some stuff is a guess. You know, forestry activities, those sort of things. That's less precise. But when you're talking about automobiles, or you know, or some industrial activities, or you know, some of the ag activities, there's a lot of variation in the ag activities. You know, some of it has to do with the sequestration property of soil, if certain fertilizers are used, or what happens in large feedlots, that sort of thing. So. That's, you know, some is precise, some is very precise, and some is not very precise at all. Mr. Chair, I was wondering I have an alternative suggestion to Senator Dill's suggestion, which is maybe we postpone the effective date for Section 4 on page 3, postpone it 2 or 3 years. Give us some time to consider and ramp up to this standard.
Senator Dibble, would you be interested in working on some of these issues that have been flagged and taking the bill up at another hearing? Or would you like to work on it now?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, we have about 4 or 5 other stops for this bill.
That is true.
So,
true.
But that's the reason we have hearings, is to surface issues and to work on them. So, you know, we can certainly stay put in this committee.
Pardon?
And we can stay put in this committee.
I'm just posing the question to you. I'll honor whatever your wishes are.
So,
Mr. Hill.
Well, could we?
So, Mr. Chair, if we can get this bill moving along, I've got about, you know, 4 or 5 other stops,
okay.
And I will honor my commitment to, you know, to work with every individual on this committee. I'm sure at least everyone will probably see it one other time, given its scope. It touches a lot of issues, schools and you know, transportation, and local government practices, and the like. And so, I will work to address every single issue. I've been taking a lot of notes.
Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Senator. Chairman, I would move to delete Section 4.
Okay. We've discussed this issue thoroughly. The motion is to delete Section 4. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple points. One is that I don't think we have enough information about who's paying these costs, because I heard two completely contradictory things just a few minutes ago. You know, are the farmers paying for EAWs, or are the local units of government paying? I would like to know a little bit more clearly what the answer to that is. And I think everyone here at the table should know that before we proceed on this. You know, the other thing, I just want to make the point that this is about looking at greenhouse gas emissions from new projects, right? That's what we're talking about. We're talking about looking at them and evaluating whether there's alternatives. And whether we're in a recession or not, if there's new projects being built that are emitting greenhouse gases, I think we run the risk of really putting our heads in the sand if we don't evaluate them sooner rather than later. Because we all know that whether we like it or not, regulation of these gases is coming. It's right around the corner. We know it's coming. Our president is committed to it. Senator McCain is committed to it. Our governor has signed a multi-state agreement with the Midwestern states committing to reducing greenhouse gas emissions in our region. Our legislature has passed goals committing to reducing those. And so if we tell businesses, go ahead and start up a new project without knowing what the impact on them in the future will be of this regulation, I think we're just setting ourselves up for failure and setting those projects up for failure. it's really kind of helping these projects say, listen, if you want to build something, great, but do it with your eyes wide open about the future, because if you don't, you're going to be hit. The hammer might come down later. And so I think this is about preparing for the future, and if we ignore it, we do it our peril, because the issue is not going to just go away because we say our proposers don't have to look at it. And they're just going to have to, you know, either they can look up front and say, how can I reduce these emissions, or are there alternatives? Or else they're going to go forward without that evaluation, be operating, and then when regulation comes down, they won't know what to do. And they're going to be at a competitive disadvantage with those businesses that have thought that through ahead of time. So I think it's not good economic or business policy for us to tell our businesses, we're gonna protect you from the future realities. And that's what I think we'd be doing if we don't start measuring and evaluating the impact of greenhouse gases.
Senator Gabritzen.
Thank you. And to that point, if I could, the testimony from both the League of Minnesota Cities as well as the counties have told me that not everybody's buying into that, quite frankly. Whether our new president or the fellow that ran against him was all in favor of it. Nevertheless, not everybody's buying in on it. And my to Senator Dill's amendment here, I think, you know, I certainly have to agree with that. I asked the question earlier of Senator Dibble with regards to this is a more of a Met Council, Met metropolitan area type issue, and I sense from Senator Stumpf and Dill that let's wait and see what happens. Let's see how successful this is before we move into the area of our state. And as Senator Olson said, we are really in dire straits right now, and we're going to stifle some business here, I think. And I'm absolutely in favor of, at the very least, deleting this, and I certainly go along with that. Thank you.
Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, to respond to Senator Anderson's comments about she wants to find out who has to pay, is it the government or the private sector? To me, it makes no difference. It's adding cost to either side, and either side doesn't have money right now, especially government. And it's a very tough economic time for anybody. We're hoping that people will start businesses and employ people and things will get going again. But I don't want to add cost to either the public sector or the private sector or add new programs. We just don't have the money for it. And I think this is something we got a lot of good ideas in this bill, and I'm a co-author on it, and I support Senator Dibble on a lot of things he's trying to do in here because I'm very interested in controlling urban sprawl. But to add this additional cost across the whole state of Minnesota, recession, depression, with unemployment rising every quarter, is the wrong thing for us to do. So I think we should delete it. We can add it back in 2 or 3 years if things look better.
Senator Sharon, and then we should vote on the amendment.
Well, as I look through Section 3 and Subdivision 2C, Section 3 really relates only to municipal ordinances. So we're not talking about an agricultural area at all. It just relates to municipal ordinances. Subdivision 2C doesn't change the stimulus or the conditions under which an environmental assessment worksheet or impact statement or alternative urban area review is initiated. There isn't anything in here that calls upon a local unit of government to do anything, any new environmental assessment under any new criteria, as I understand this. Whatever institutes that review process is not changed in this bill. All it does is say, in the process of doing that, would you look at emissions from, would you identify and consider alternatives and mitigation to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? I don't think that that's an overly burdensome addition to the process, and a process that's already in place, and there isn't anything that really is saying it has to be done more frequently, or it's the same stimulus is in place as was whether we pass this or not.
Seems like it would help drive the LEQA program, Senator Dill.
Drive the what?
It would help drive the LEQA program.
What's that?
This is the feedlot cost share program that that's kind of has emerged, and it's been a really good program. So something like this could really help drive that program's the need for it. Something to think about. Last word, Senator Dibble, then we got to vote.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer a substitute motion, substitute amendment.
And who pays for it?
I'd like to delay the effective date 2 years. Say something like this section takes effect like August 1st, 2011. And, Mr. Chair, as I've stated previously, I've made a commitment to work on these issues that give folks heartburn, whether it's a metropolitan area versus the rest of the state issue. We can talk about that. I'm very open to talking about that, finding some threshold, and we have some thresholds actually that already exist. So, you know, this is, to Senator Sharon's point, this isn't automatically triggered or creating new sorts of things. The University of Minnesota provide the, you know, a lot of the cost that's going to that might be implied here. If the University of Minnesota comes up with all the technical information, that we're not talking about a lot of new cost and environmental worksheets. Those are all, you know, so three things that we can work on at least. And also, if we delay the effective date 2 years, gets to Senator Dill's concern about the immediate economic issues.
Okay, so Senator Dibble is moving to amend Senator Dill's motion by reinserting Section 4 and adding an effective date of
August
1, 2011. Does anybody understand the amendment to the amendment?
Can you amend and reverse the whole? I think you have to act on one before you introduce one that goes the opposite direction.
Yeah, but
this is an amendment to the amendment,
right?
And it's a substitute motion, and he's just saying that his amendment would reinsert it and put a different effective date on it.
Okay.
Okay. Does everybody understand that? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. On the Dill motion to delete Section 4, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Excuse me, the motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, may I have a division?
Division has been requested. All those in favor of the Dill motion to delete Section 4, please raise your hand. Counting.
There's 9 votes in favor.
Okay. All those opposed?
6.
On a vote of 9-6, the motion does prevail. Further discussion on Senate File 549. Seeing none, Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 549 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Energy.
Yes. Do you want an effective date on that one proposal?
There was a suggestion by counsel on an effective date of the Bowser provision, the wetland provision. Yes. Senator, excuse me, Mr. Knopf, will you read that for us?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it'd be Section 2. It's on the bottom of page 2. After 2.35, insert effective date. This section is effective August 1, 2009, and applies to rulemaking that begins after that date. There was some concern that the Bowser rulemaking is already there in the process and whether this would affect them in the middle of a rulemaking. So it would only be if they make any rules that are adopted after that or begun after that date, any rulemaking procedures, then they would have to consider the carbon sequestration of wetlands.
That makes sense to Bowser? Everyone understand that? Senator Dibble, you move that language. Everyone understand that on the Dibble amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. On the Senator Dibble motion to recommend, Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, just a question on the wetlands area. Is the... When we deal with carbon sequestration, what was the rationale so that it wasn't greenhouse gases versus carbon sequestration.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand.
Oh, okay. Well, the, wetlands in section 4 that was deleted, the term greenhouse gases was a term that applied to a larger definition. On the section relating to wetlands, it's just carbon sequestration. What was the rationale the difference between that? Why,
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, I'm not a technical expert, so maybe Bowser can help me. But as I understand, wetlands are carbon sinks. They draw carbon in and they capture it. I don't know if they draw in things like methane and capture it. Maybe they do, but you know it's the physical activity, the physical action, the physical effect that wetlands have. They draw in carbon, and keep it in place. Maybe they do with all the others. Hold that. Sorts of gases that are out in the climate.
Senator Saxhog.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just reiterate kind of what Senator Dibble said. These were the positive values of wetlands, and sequestration is a huge positive value.
On the Dibble motion, want to understand it? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dibble. We have time for Senator Rummel's bill.
Chair and members.
Thank you. Senator Rummel. Senate File 237. This is the subject of the joint hearing with the Health Committee that we had last week, I believe. The Health Committee subsequently passed this bill and referred it to our committee. Senator Rummel, welcome to the committee.
IPCC studies going to be picked.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We don't like that. So we're
since it's been over a week since we heard the bill, I hope you will indulge me. I know you've put up a really thoughtful and rigorous session just now, and you must be tired. But I'd like to go over the key points of the bill briefly. I have only 4 points to make. And then I would like to offer an A1 amendment. I'm hoping somebody will offer that for me. First of all, let's remind ourselves what BPA is. It's a building block of polycarbonate plastic. It is also a hormone disruptor that acts like estrogen. This disruptor can trigger malfunctions of genes. These are unwanted effects, resulting in unwanted actions affecting neurological and reproductive systems, especially in developing infants and children. In laboratory experiments, BPA has been associated with heart disease, diabetes, obesity, prostate and breast cancer, and other neurological disorders such as ADHD. What does the bill do? In two words, the bill protects babies. Infants and babies have bodies that are developing very, very fast. This development is controlled by genes that send messages in a sequence. And if that sequence is broken, down the line, harmful effects can occur, such as those I just mentioned. The bill phases out. That's the first thing it does. It's very modest. It's only for children under the age of 3. And it phases BPA out of plastics that are found in baby bottles, sippy cups, and other hard plastic toys that children are likely to put in their mouths. The second thing it does is it phases out infant formula containers by the year 2013. And I have, since I last met with you, I've been in additional conversation with Kevin Fisk from the Grocery Manufacturing Association. Kevin is going to get me some new information. I'm working closely with him. If we need to change something in terms of the dates, we did hear, and we're trying to follow up on this, that Gerber and Nestle have already made some plans to change their packaging. But I'm trying to verify that, so I don't want you to write that in stone. But I'm working closely with the Grocery Manufacturing Association, and we are open to adjusting this in ways that they suggest are reasonable. Why am I bringing this bill now? Constituents want the confidence that the products they buy for their children are safe. Okay. It's that simple. This past summer, I don't know if you recall, we had a Senate survey at the State Fair. 78% of the people that responded to that survey said, we do not want harmful chemicals in our children's toys and products. There are 14 other states working on this bill, and as you know, Canada has already banned BPA in baby bottles, just that limited. Finally, there were some questions about the research. I would suggest that the research is on the side of the public. We had 189 independent government studies. Now, these are folks that have no skin in the game that said this is a chemical of concern. The National Toxicology Program and the Science Board that advises the FDA have suggested that the FDA look beyond the 14 studies that were conducted by industry. They suggest that those studies were flawed using outdated science. And I don't know if you recall, last year, on January 15th, our own Minnesota Pollution Control Agency submitted a report on estrogen-disrupting compounds. And while it had nothing to do with my bill, I think you would find it interesting, I'm going to read a sentence from here, that they support the same research that we used. In other words, they went to the 189 studies that we are using to support our bill. And they say, as demonstrated by several of the studies cited in this report, endocrine disruption can involve more than just sex hormones. In fact, there are many hormones produced by endocrine systems of humans, wildlife, all of which have important roles in maintaining bodily processes. While there are still many unanswered questions, the evidence that chemicals can adversely impact the endocrine functions in humans, fish, and wildlife is mounting. And that's after review of the same science we used.
Senator Rummel, we have about a minute left.
Okay,
so
why don't
we have Senator Sieben move the A1? Would that be all right?
I'm fine with that, Senator Rummel.
All right. This reduces the scope of your bill.
Yes. Well, it clarifies. This bill has nothing to do with cans that grocery stores put on.
That's true. It did not in the at first, but this clarifies that.
On
the A1, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. On Senate File 237, Senator Sieben.
247 to do
it. 247.
What's 247? Okay. I'm sorry. Senator Sieben, would you like to make the motion?
Sure.
Senator Sieben will move that Senate File 247 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the committee.
As amended.
As amended, thank you. Re-referred to the Committee on Business, Jobs, and Industry. Senator, on that motion, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Just one question, if I could, of the author. Are there or are there not... Do mothers have a choice when they go to the store to buy something that does not have this ingredient?
Yes, there are.
There are. Okay, thank you.
No, not for everything. Not for everything.
Sorry?
Senator Sieben?
Well, as a mother who's trying to determine which sippy cups to buy, I can tell you that there's no solid information as to when you go to the store to know whether a sippy cup, for instance, contains BPA or not.
There are alternative products in the stores, but they're not well identified. And so for safety's sake,
you don't know
that what we are asking is that no products for children under the age of 3 not be allowed. So then no matter which, right now you can go in and buy a sippy cup, but you don't know if it has BPA or not. So that's the problem. That's why I'm bringing the bill. There are products that are safe, but they're not always marked.
On the Sieben motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No other business before the committee. The meeting's adjourned.
Testimony there that there was. I heard testimony there the day that there was.
I thought there was.